This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
Welcome to the Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the place where you and I get briefed together on the tricky questions of the moment by folk who actually know what they're talking about. Now, if it works for you, or even if it doesn't, please communicate by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. A shout out to those of you who have recently reviewed us, including WPI Now, Park 106, and LetMK4001. And this week, we're asking what kind of relationship is Britain seeking with the European Union after Brexit? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might want to listen back to other editions of The Briefing Room. Last week, for example, we asked if NATO could survive without the United States. Less than 2 weeks ago, Theresa May locked her cabinet into her country retreat and didn't let them out until they'd all agreed a document containing Britain's proposal for its future relationship with the European Union.
We're delivering on the vote of the British people to take back control of our money, our laws and our borders, and that's what our proposal does. We're also ensuring that as we do that, we protect people's lives, livelihoods and their jobs. And that we, of course, deliver on our commitment to Northern Ireland, that there should be no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland.
Unity was swiftly followed by discordance. The PM lost David Davis, followed by Boris Johnson, and then barely survived a series of knife-edge votes in the Commons on motions related to the EU. So what was actually in the Chequers Agreement? What changed this week? And what will the European Union make of it? To help me through this, I'm joined live in the Briefing Room by Adrian Waldridge, the political editor of The Economist and author of the Badgett column. Adrian Waldridge, we had the Chequers plan. Was it your impression that when they came out of Chequers, Theresa May thought she had absolutely squared everybody, that would be it, no resignations, boldly onwards?
Absolutely. I think the impression you got immediately was that this was a really good deal, that she'd managed to bring everybody on board. Nobody was going to resign. Boris Johnson had stood up and toasted her agreements. The Conservative Party had its tail up, and things fell apart very rapidly after that.
Now, why did they?
Well, the first thing that happened was that David Davis resigned. He resigned just before midnight on the Sunday afterwards. That was a huge shock to Downing Street. And it's not entirely clear why he did it. I think he did it primarily because of the process rather than the substance of what had been agreed. He'd been persistently sidelined by Ollie Robbins.
So he didn't. He decided in retrospect he didn't like the way he'd been treated, and that's the one.
I suspect that was it.
And Boris Johnson?
I think that then it becomes, losing one person was tolerable, but Boris Johnson then saw David Davis resigning And I think that tipped him into resigning, perhaps for reasons of ambition, perhaps for reasons of principle. But that was, I think, if Davis hadn't gone, Johnson wouldn't have gone.
Now, all of a sudden, this kind of positive atmosphere you were talking about seemed to go within the idea, within the Conservative Party itself, seemed to turn the other direction.
Yes, I mean, it was extraordinary how rapidly it happened. On Monday morning, I think people were saying that she was facing down the Brexiteers, that the Brexiteers should either put up or shut up, that this was a triumph for the Prime Minister. She actually had some real solutions to difficult problems, which the Brexiteers had never come up with. And then that atmosphere changed when losing Boris Johnson, David Davis, but, and also Steve Baker. I think he tends to get lost in this, but he was an important, significant person to lose. And then we had, I think, still a sense for a while that she was the dominant person in the party.
So she's still defiant.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've still resigned.
And she gave a very good speech on the Monday afternoon. You know, she just lost her foreign secretary. It was actually one of her better performances in the Commons. I think a pretty feisty performance.
And then it all seems to change. Absolutely. And then all of a sudden you get these amendments. Now, these amendments weren't to the white paper because it wasn't being discussed. So you get these amendments to what?
Well, the amendments are to the customs bill that's going through, and they're extraordinarily technical and extraordinarily complicated. Recently, one of the amendments affects medical agreements, very, very complicated things. But what they are essentially is a test of strength. The Brexiteers felt, I think, a bit threatened. They decided to test their strength, and her response to that was immediately to give in. And by giving in, she really weakened her own position, and she meant, and it also meant that the soft Brexiteers, the Europhiles, if you can call them, also had to test their strength.
But Eamon Wooldridge, this is something that listeners may find hard to understand. These weren't actually amendments about the white paper. They weren't amendments about the Chequers plan. They were amendments about something else, but they were regarded as tests of strength about what eventually the Chequers plan white paper would be.
They were extraordinarily complicated amendments to very complicated legislation, which I'm sure most of the people who voted for or against them had never read in the first place and couldn't understand, but they were very real tests of strength. And by giving in so completely to the Brexiteers, I think she massively undermined her position.
But why did she do it?
I think because she sees her job essentially as party management. She sees them as a powerful group within the party, and she's tended to always want to consolidate her position on her right, particularly as she was originally a Remainer. She's always given into the Brexiteers, and she continues to have that reversal. She sees party management as the essential thing that she's doing.
But it took her right to the brink of catastrophic defeat.
Absolutely. It was a miscalculation, and it took her to the brink of defeat, partly because, you know, we're in a knife-edge parliament, but partly because it created an equal and opposite reaction from Anna Soubry and her people.
Adrian Wooldridge, thank you. You and I will speak again later. But first, we need to know what it is that is actually in that Chequers agreement and how much of it has survived the bruising it's received in Parliament this week. Joining me earlier in the briefing room was Jill Rutter, former Treasury and Number 10 civil servant and now Programme Director at the Institute of Government. I started by asking her what the difference was between the agreement struck at Chequers 2 weeks ago and Theresa May's 2017 Lancaster House Declaration.
So there's some quite big differences in key areas. So first difference is on goods, where the Prime Minister says in this that rather than just have a sort of deep free trade agreement, she's quite vague about what she wanted in Lancaster House. In the Chequers white paper, she sets out some provisions whereby the UK would basically stay completely aligned, though subject to what she calls a parliamentary lock, stay aligned with a new thing we haven't heard of before called the Common Rule Book, which basically means that where you would otherwise need a check at the border, if the UK had different rules to the EU, we would basically stay with the EU rules, so you didn't need those border checks. The second one is she's now come down on a choice on customs, and what she's offering is a rather complicated arrangement called a facilitated customs arrangement, where there's a sort of dual tariff regime run by the UK. So if a good comes in and it's supposed to be staying in the UK, it pays a UK tariff. If it's going somewhere else in the EU, it pays an EU tariff, and there is a revenue sharing formula The sort of third big area she's moved is she's now proposing a sort of much more complicated governance structure for the whole arrangement, with sort of institutional oversight, a joint committee, a governing body for the relationship. But there are also some provisions there, and this is interesting because one of her big red lines was ending the direct jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. She is saying, yeah, we don't have direct jurisdiction of the ECJ. Cases that arise in Britain would be decided by British courts. But it would be possible to refer issues about interpretation of EU law to the European Court of Justice, and then a final arbitration arrangement which would oversee the enforcement of the deal would take account of those ECJ decisions.
In general terms, what was anticipated immediately after the Chequers Agreement was that this somehow kind of represented a movement, because after all, I imagine it's a negotiating position, isn't it? Or is it an aspiration, or is it a vision?
It could be any of those things, but it's certainly not the sort of final word. What had been happening is the Prime Minister had, in a series of speeches, been putting out what the UK was moving towards as its position. And remember, she went on a journey from Lancaster House to Florence in September last year, and then to Mansion House, where she kept on fleshing out bits of the UK position. This was supposed to be a definitive statement, if you like, of the UK's opening position. Of course, politically, it was supposed to do something else, which was the government was worried about the customs and trade bills that we've had votes on this week. And it was at the time particularly worried that there was seemed to be a move in Parliament to say we need to stay in the customs union. And what the Prime Minister, I think, was trying to do through this was saying, look, you don't need to vote to stay in a customs union. I've found a different way of guaranteeing frictionless trade for goods.
Now, the first reaction to the original Chequers Agreement, the original one, from quite a lot of what you might call soft Brexiteers was, oh, this is not too bad, really. I mean, maybe it's signalling a move towards what we very loosely call a Norway-type arrangement, which is some form of membership of the single market, a closer customs agreement. Was that how you interpreted it?
It was certainly appeared to be a softening. And what it really interestingly was, the UK for quite a long time had been hooked on this view that actually there was a way of, you know, to quote the former foreign secretary, there was a way of having your cake and eating it. And that was basically that we would have our rules, the EU would have their rules, they probably wouldn't be very different, and we could just recognise each other's rules. And for a long time, both in Florence last year and then in Mansion House, the Prime Minister is saying, it's OK, we can square this circle through this thing called mutual recognition, which has been pushed very hard by some of the very influential voices outside government. And I think what Chequers realised was actually mutual recognition was not going to fly in Europe. And that's why the Prime Minister has gone for this common rule book on goods. And what's quite interesting in this is the Prime Minister signed up to a bunch of commitments, remember, in that report in December, agreed with the EU27 to get the judgment of sufficient progress, to saying we will stay aligned enough to make sure there's no need for those hard border checks. She's trying to do the minimum she needs here to be able to say, actually, OK, EU, you won't need to put in those sorts of checks along the Irish border.
So you make it sound as if actually what this is hard Brexit, except with a customs arrangement which allows you to solve the Irish border problem.
It's almost that, I think. I think it's quite a hard Brexit, but it says that there are some areas that we need to preserve frictionless trade on goods. And remember, in the past few weeks, we've had people like Airbus, Jaguar Land Rover all coming out saying, if you disrupt our just-in-time supply chains, this is really bad impacts on jobs. So I think that's why we've got this customs proposal, which is designed to try and reconcile the desire to be able to run an independent trade policy and control our tariffs with the need for not having to have customs formalities between the UK and the EU, and the need to avoid regulatory checks at the border, because we've stuck with enough of the rules that they don't have to do that.
Now, we have a deficit with the EU in goods, but we have a surplus in services. So why are services not part of an agreement?
That's a very interesting question, because you could argue this is giving the EU a really good deal. And there are various reasons that the UK might have done that. The reason they put in the white paper is that these are dynamic areas where we want to benefit from regulatory flexibility. They contrast the flexibility in these areas with the relatively stable rule book on goods. Those are quotes from the white paper. So there's more flexibility. There are areas where David Davis earlier in the week was saying the EU's not done very good trade deals for us. It doesn't do very much on services. The truth is trade deals don't do very much on services. Generally, there's been big noises from the city and quite a big debate about whether the city wants to be a rule taker from the EU or not. And we've heard that people like the Bank of England are particularly worried about being a rule taker. And remember, these would be rules that were set with a British voice no longer at the table, so they could be quite different rules. And there's also another thing, which is one of the things the Prime Minister is absolutely clear about, and this is one of the absolutely consistent themes, is that the one thing Brexit really does mean is an end to free movement. And there is an argument that if she'd asked for basically alignment on goods and services, that's pretty well indistinguishable from the single market. And then the EU would say, sorry, the four freedoms really are indivisible and you have to have free movement, and that that would be really not recognising the result of the referendum.
So free movement still stops any position advanced by this government from remaining in a single market with the EU position. Let's look at some of the areas where perhaps Theresa May's famous red lines have blurred. Has she changed her position a bit on the role of the European Court of Justice, which was a big, big thing for hard Brexiteers?
Yes, I think she has changed a bit. She actually changed a bit in Mansion House when she said the UK wanted to stay part of some of the EU agencies. So she's made clear that where we want to stay part of an EU agency, we would respect the ECJ's remit with respect to that agency. But they've gone a bit further in the Chequers white paper, where they now talk about the role of the ECJ in dispute resolution. And in particular, that although they're sort of separate mechanisms for resolving disputes between the UK and the EU, those don't get resolved by the ECJ. That would be a bit unfair because that's their court, not our court. There are mechanisms for pushing decisions where you need a sort of interpretation of EU law as part of that dispute resolutions to the ECJ for an interpretation, and then it comes back. There's also something saying, you know, where the UK is basically running EU rules, so through the common rule book that we talked about before, that the UK courts would pay due regard to ECJ decisions. Before, in the EU Withdrawal Act, we simply said that where they're interpreting laws we'd inherited from the EU, they might pay due regard, they may pay due regard. So that's a bit of a difference as well. So a bit of a bigger role for ECJ.
Jill Rutter. Of course, what was agreed in Chequers and rowed about in Westminster was only one side of the argument, a negotiating position. The EU will have its own thoughts. Dominic Raab, the man who replaced David Davis as Brexit secretary, was there today for the first time to meet the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, and may have found out what some of those thoughts are. Joining me earlier in the briefing room, down the line from Brussels, was the Europe editor of the Irish Times, Patrick Smith. I asked him what the thinking was at the EU end.
Well, there's a meeting tomorrow of ministers who are going to give their first response to the British White Paper, and they will also consider a paper from the Commission on the what's called preparedness, which is basically every member state preparing itself for the departure.
Is there any discussion about the EU talking about preparing for the possibility of a no-deal Brexit?
The preparedness paper that I just mentioned from the Commission is actually about all eventualities, both the soft Brexit and hard Brexit and no Brexit. And there's certainly a discussion going on, has got more serious in the last few days about the possibility of no deal and the implications for each of the member states and the Commission itself.
Why is that?
Well, for example, on Ireland, one of the issues that isn't clear is whether or not the commitment by the British government to the frictionless border in Ireland is one that is unconditional, or is it like everything else that has been discussed so far, that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed? In other words, if it is unconditional, then the preparations have to be made for a frictionless border in Ireland by agreement with the British, who will have to implement a whole range of customs measures and the like on the border, rather akin to their other proposals. It's a very complicated discussion.
Now, the question of the Irish border seems to be that essentially, unless we actually have a full solution agreed by October, then we won't have a withdrawal agreement, let alone be able to progress to a discussion of the long-term shape of a British exit.
That's correct, yes. And basically what the European Union is saying is that we reached an agreement in December. We want that in legal form in a withdrawal agreement. If we don't get an agreement on the backstop, which is what the Irish protocol is about, then both the transition and the rest of the withdrawal agreement will go by the board.
So no detail from the British government which satisfies the EU on the backstop means no agreement on the withdrawal and no transition period. And therefore, automatically, it means for the long term a no-deal Brexit.
A powerful incentive to talk and to talk seriously.
A hugely powerful incentive, but it's kind of like you trip on one step and you fall down the whole flight.
You can say that, but the reality is that the talks process has been about getting commitments gradually on a number of things and tying down those commitments so that, that there's no backtracking on them. What's happening at the moment, as the EU sees it, is that the British are backtracking on the commitment they made in December. And it is impossible to conduct negotiations if things that are agreed are no longer agreed. And therefore, there is a remarkable unity among the 27 remaining member states that the Irish backstop must be resolved.
Now, the EU default position, as I understand it, is that if we can't come up with some kind of solution about frictionless trade on the Irish border, then in that case, the border will have to be in the Irish Sea. Now, this is described by people in Britain as annexing Northern Ireland to the EU. How does Ireland see that?
Ireland isn't particularly keen on that because, in fact, east-west trade is actually significantly more important to the Irish than north-south trade. And so they much prefer a deal in which Britain and the EU agree on a customs arrangement that will cover the whole of Ireland. But they are adamant, too, that short of that, and that is going to be very difficult to get, they need to copper fasten a deal in Northern Ireland to protect the gains of the Belfast Agreement. And that is what the backstop is about. Now, it should be said that Barnier has been playing down the severity of the so-called border in the Irish Sea. He's been talking about de-dramatising it and saying, yeah, but we might be talking about a few technical tests on cattle and some goods. It doesn't have to be a full political border. In fact, it's not a border, he says very firmly. But that's still not acceptable to the unionists and to London at the moment, though I suspect it will be eventually.
Well, let's widen it out a bit now. Let's talk about what it is that the EU, what you've heard people in the EU make of the white paper, the Chequers Agreement.
There are serious reservations about it. Now, I would add that I think it's quite interesting the way the paper has been written in a way that actually ticks a number of EU boxes. But there are major problems still, and that, for example, cherry-picking of the market is really problematic. And the distinction that the British are drawing between goods and services is something that the EU can't accept because it goes to the four freedoms which the EU says are essential parts of the Union.
In the EU view, is Britain actually, the British polity, actually capable of agreeing something which it can put to the EU and then actually agree itself?
I think that's the big question, and we honestly don't know. There doesn't appear to be a majority in Parliament for any form of Brexit. So people here are bewildered and watching these shenanigans in the Commons with considerable interest but concern.
Patrick Smith. Now, still with me in the briefing room is Adrian Wooldridge of The Economist. And Adrian, let's talk about just that. I mean, and where we go from here. Is the biggest problem that the next stages face agreement within Parliament, or is it EU doubts about what it is that we can achieve?
I think the only certainty we have over the next few months is things are going to get a lot worse than they've been already. That the EU will push back on Mrs. May's proposals, and that will mean that more members of the Tory party will split away from her, will become angry. So the coalition that she has, which can just about get her stuff through Parliament, will be weakened still further because, you know, they've reached the outer limit of what they're willing to accept.
That involves something of a political calculation in the first instance. I mean, the old model was that in times of crisis like this, most Tories would actually gather back behind the leader because they can see the consequences of such division. Now, what you're suggesting, actually, is that the polarisation is going so far that bring back together force no longer operates.
Well, the Tory party used to be the natural party of government that believed in the art of the possible, in compromise and things like that. I think it's becoming a party that's driven, or a big faction of it is a party that's driven overwhelmingly by ideology. And the Brexiteers are driven overwhelmingly by ideology. What Mrs. May seemed to do was to split the pragmatic wing of the Brexiteers from the complete ideological hardcore of the Brexiteers. And what's going to happen is that the ideological hardcore is going to get bigger as a result of what Brussels comes back and says from this. So I think the revolutionary wing of the Conservative Party, as it were, is going to get bigger. And I cannot see how we can get her compromise through Parliament.
Is it going to get bigger because that's what the Conservative Party in the country wants? And if so, has she got a strategy for dealing with that?
I think the Conservative Party in the country is a Brexit party overwhelmingly. About 75% of Conservative Party members are Brexiteers. The Brexiteer wing of the Parliamentary Party is smaller, but it's big enough. And we've seen what it can do even when confronted with the Chequers Agreement. When confronted with the Chequers Agreement as modified by negotiations with Brussels, it will be much stronger.
Now, do you think all this makes a no-deal exit? And we heard right at the top of the programme in the news segment the IMF warning everybody
Absolutely.
About what a no-deal situation would mean. Do you think that it actually makes a no-deal more likely?
Absolutely. I cannot see how Theresa May can get a watered-down version of the Chequers Agreement through the Conservative Party. Now, what do you do then? You get Labour votes. Well, will enough Labour people be willing to support her? It's hard to see that. So you then have to try and unstop all of this. You can have a general election. You can have a new referendum. You can have a party of national unity. But I think the simple business of relying on the votes of Tory MPs will not get us out of this. There aren't enough people who are willing to put pragmatism above ideology.
So there are a whole lot of calculations there. Now, one of the things that's been raised in the last couple of days is the idea that what we should need to do now is to extend Article 50, that actually we can do this with the European agreement, make the transition period longer, make the period in which we can decide these things even longer, and that will give us the time we need.
Theresa May's strategy all the way through has been to kick the can down the road. And I think the only way that she can survive in some sort of order is to do that again with the agreement of the European Union to extend this Article 50. It was insane in the first place to trigger Article 50 before you'd actually
agree on what you were going to say. Well, hold on, everybody's incredibly keen on it. If you remember, almost yes. the day after the referendum, Jeremy Corbyn was saying, invoke Article 50 now. So it wasn't just Theresa May doing
it. Wasn't just her, although some of the leading Brexiteers, I think the argument used was like it was like putting a gun to your own head and pulling the trigger. It was foolish not to get some sort of sense of what you wanted before you did that. They thought that putting a time limit on things would discipline people and get them to think about this seriously. Well, what we've seen is that's not happened.
Now, the other suggestion which is going around, or one of the other suggestions, is the second referendum and so on. You know, break the logjam, say whatever it is that we're going to come up with, we're going to put that to a second referendum, which means that everybody can get on with the business simply discussing what's going to be in that package.
The question is what you put as a second referendum. Do you put stay or leave? Do you put stay, leave or checkers? Do you put checkers or leave? There's a whole series of permutations. That's going to be difficult in the first place. I think it's difficult to put referendum before the people in the time available. And I think there's quite a serious possibility that if people were offered the chance to say, to vote for a hard Brexit, a no-deal Brexit, that enough of them would do it, that it's a real possibility. So the notion that many Remainers have that we should be allowed to rethink this, we can vote again, we'll vote to remain, and all of this awfulness will just disappear. Well, I wish that were the case myself, but it's not necessarily the case. We could actually end up with the worst situation we've got already.
Now, look, with this Parliament that was elected in 2017, is there a majority for any particular kind of Brexit?
I think there is a majority in Parliament for a soft, pragmatic Brexit. Most MPs are sensible people. Most MPs went into politics to try and solve problems. But that collection of MPs who believe in a sensible soft Brexit is split between the two big parties plus the Liberal Democrats. And what Labour people would have to do is essentially to vote for the Conservative Prime Minister to solve her problems. Would they do that?
And you don't think they would?
I think I wouldn't rule it out entirely. It is one possibility.
In that case, Adrian Waldron, I'm not at all sure that the listeners shouldn't be rather scared. My thanks to you, to Jill Rutter and Patrick Smith. And we'll be back with The Briefing Room next week. Until then, goodbye. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Olivia Beasley. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. And you can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. We really do enjoy hearing from you.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Welt, in der sich Technologie und künstliche Intelligenz weiterentwickeln, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um Ihre Daten und Netzwerke vor Cyberrisiken zu schützen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.
Hello, it's Ray Winstone. I'm here to tell you about my podcast on BBC Radio 4, History's Toughest Heroes. I've got stories about the pioneers, the rebels, the outcasts who define tough.
And that was the first time that anybody ever ran a car up that fast with no tires on. It almost feels like your eyeballs are going to come out of your head.
Tough enough for you? Subscribe to History's Toughest Heroes wherever you get your podcast.